All right, today is May 26th, 2015. This is the fourth interview with Linda Newman. We are here in Steenbach Memorial Library up in the University Archives, and my name is Troy Reeves. Linda, to help us out here with sound quality, could you say your name and spell your last name?
Certainly. This is Linda Newman, and my last name is spelled N-E-W-M-A-N.
I'm going to get a little closer to you, and then I'm going to project a little bit, so I'm not yelling at you. I'm just making sure my questions get on the record, so to speak.
Okay.
Linda, we just talked about the topic, so let's hit the first topic by asking you to reiterate, because I'm sure you said in the first session, why move from the history department to the job that you took in the School of Education?
The reason that I took the job in the School of Education was because an academic staff position in a department can be, or was at that point, a very lonely position. So although there were academic staff working in the history department, we were not sort of natural colleagues. They were involved in research projects. So in some sense, the people that I knew best were the classified staff. And I made wonderful friends among the classified staff. I knew the faculty from having been a grad student and also because I worked with them every day. But in retrospect, I would say the status difference was significant. There was only one faculty person, and I must say I was deeply shocked, who said to me that somebody or other shouldn't be asking you questions because you're only academic staff. For the most part, the history department was, and I believe is, extremely egalitarian as the faculty saw it. But egalitarianism from those in a status far higher than one's own isn't the same. So I was very interested in, partly through my work at SOAR, having more responsibility at a level beyond the department. At the same time, in all of my time working at the university, I have felt profoundly what it means to belong to an academic department, and I have some skepticism about staff who have never had an academic department home, just in terms of how do you understand the whole if you weren't part of that kind of a part, because the university is still, thanks be to God, faculty-driven, which I believe is as it should be, and discipline-driven. But that said, it's an enormously complicated institution. And the job description appealed to me. I liked the people that I met when I went across up the hill a little bit from the humanities building, and the dean there, then John Palmer, was a historian. And when they did hire me, he was very frank in saying I was their absolutely definite second choice. And the first choice was somebody who was really, I think he said it was some time ago, that she really wanted her home job to appreciate her more, which I guess they did after she got an offer. Mm-hmm. So she stayed there. Mm-hmm.
So, I think you talked about this on the record in the first session, and I don't know if we've talked about it sort of off the record per se, but in our notes here, I have in quotes sort of tumult.
Oh, yes.
The job there.
Okay.
So maybe the next question is, I hope there was a honeymoon period before some of this other
emphatically,
stuff started.
Emphatically.
So maybe if you could sort of talk about the honeymoon period.
Sure.
First.
It was very congenial. When I interviewed, I was on the first floor, and the student academic services was in the basement, so it was a little bit of a shock to be in the basement. But as compared to humanities, and John Palmer, dean then, was, as I said, an historian, very gracious. The focus was teacher education. And I gradually learned about the other disciplines in the School of Ed. And I went in charge of a staff of about 9 people, unfamiliar with administration. And I had very good people working for me and could hire more. So it came to be maybe 5 academic staff and 3 or 4 classified staff. And I learned over time that the classified staff whom I supervised were somewhat idiosyncratic in the whole institution. So one of the things when I had accepted the job was that I met with the dean and he explained that we would not be invited to his Christmas party, which I very much took in stride. It wasn't something I had thought about one way or the other, but apparently under the previous dean of student services, the classified staff had been more than generous with themselves at the bar. And the other issue that came up immediately was that the classified staff were very, very committed to crocheting on the noon hour and closing the office. So one of my very first directives was that we were going to be open all 8 hours, which made perfect sense to me. And I had a very, very steep learning curve having taught liberal arts students and now teaching teacher preparation students. My very first impression was that teacher preparation students dressed with far more care and sensitivity than liberal arts students did, and I needed to kind of conform a little bit there myself. And I loved working there. I loved the interaction with faculty who spent a fair amount of their time in schools. So that one way to describe leaving history in LNS, coming over to the School of Ed, is that faculty did applied work. And when I got to know rehab psych and special ed faculty as well as curriculum faculty, that the same held true. The School of Ed is quite a different place now, as is the whole university. and I got campus-wide responsibilities in addition to SOAR, looking at how registration impacts students, how we manage enrollment. I was one of many across campus who would gather to discuss the kinds of issues, such issues as how do you persuade faculty to offer courses 3 times a week instead of 2 times a week, at least some of the time. And I also, and I don't have the chronology of this particularly, took advantage of being in the School of Ed and was able to sit in on, as I had done in the history department a few times, sit in on 1 or 2 education courses, one on qualitative research that was fascinating. And I also got involved with the campus-wide efforts around quality improvement. Quality improvement started, so far as I know, here on campus in the statistics department. But there very quickly came to be an understanding that that kind of approach to organizations where you were listening really carefully to the people actually doing the work had a lot of promise for those who believed in it. And I can remember that one of the assistant deans, Hank Luffler, at that time was extremely skeptical that anything could be accomplished by, so to say, allowing academic staff with administrative responsibilities to step away from their desks during the day to learn things. Well, different ways of thinking about things. So it was very positive. I had a very good staff, a tremendous focus on the well-being of students. One of the ongoing concerns in the School of Ed right up to today is within the teacher preparation programs, the expense of educating a teacher meant that the classes we could admit were small. And the university was struggling with how do you educate incoming freshmen who are admitted in terms of their desired major, which is a very young point in time to be focusing on a major, so I had quibbles with that, but that was the way we did it. And then within the first two or three years, educating those same students that in order to get into the program that would prepare you to teach social studies, you needed to have a pretty high GPA and a certain amount of courses along the way. So we worked with pre-categories. I helped to move the pre-categories out of the College of Letters and Science over to the School of Ed so that the students intending to be secondary teachers would be working with advisors in the School of Ed right off the bat. The campus also, at that point at least, was very flexible for students to change directions. The students did not invariably know that. So part of our task, as I saw it, was to encourage them in the direction they were moving, talk to them about what was required for that direction, and then step back from that focus to say, the university itself offers a variety of majors in a variety of schools and colleges. They are all open to you. But how the pieces you've done so far will line up in terms of a desired major is different depending on how you define the goal. And I was then and am fascinated now with how best to teach people one person at a time so that they feel comfortable elaborating the questions they have about the process and the alternatives which attract them when there can be pressure generated that you need to start at A and proceed directly to Z, sort of with no side visits. And I'm all about side visits. I think the traditional 18 to 22, 18 to 24 time in a person's life at a place like UW-Madison needs to be a time for the combination of accomplishing the sort of task for a given semester, but always recognizing that you could take the same bundle of credits and go in a different direction. Or, as I would sometimes advise students, take time away and come back. And over the time that I was here, the pressure from the students themselves and family increased many, many fold, so that the freshmen were much more anxious entering. Not to waste any time was one of the ways that they would approach it, which I knew was a translation for how hard they had worked to get here, how stringent the academic standards had been in order that they could get in, and from my perspective, how mistaken the notion was that there wasn't any room to wonder and think about stuff. So there was a little tension with that. And after a certain amount of time, John Palmer retired. And at that time, Donna Shalala was the chancellor, and she hired a very accomplished academician and administrator from who had grown up in Mexico. I don't know what his job previous to coming into the School of Ed was. And his notions about the place of teacher education in comparison to the arts and kinesiology, which were all majors in the School of Ed, was very different from what Palmer's was. And perhaps unrelated to that, I'm not sure. But at that time, the School of Ed had a student services office, which I directed, and a field experiences office, which was directed by Emily Comstock. And sort of before I knew really what was happening, Dean Trueba had decided that the two offices needed to be merged and that Emily Comstock needed to become the director. And I was then demoted to being senior student services coordinator, which in retrospect was probably a very good decision given that he was putting the two units together. My strength is very much working person to person and in groups of people. I'm not such a great administrator if there is a contradiction. and I am such a weak administrator that I don't necessarily see the contradiction from this distance. But it was very hard, and there was a certain amount of negative energy directed at me by Emily's staff, so it was a little bit as if they thought maybe they had won, which I think is a short-sighted way to look at it. I kept sore and kept my campus-wide role as sore, and I saw more students, which I loved. And to just the question of whether or not that was a fair disposal of my time perhaps contributed to my getting very involved in academic staff governance, because I think it was after that transition that I was invited first to be president of MASA, and from having been president of MASA went on to be a member of ASEC and then became chair of ASEC. But at the time that I got demoted, I went to see, probably by that time, Associate Dean Hank Loeffler, and his name is coming up negatively right here. I thought the world of Hank, and still do. He wasn't everybody's cup of tea. He was a very powerful man, and I thought wonderfully charming. And I went to see him, and I said, Hank, is there any point, because that's really what I meant, is there any point in my making a fuss about this shift? And he looked at me and said, I hope not, because it would make work for me. Well, I took that advice in the sense that I also knew by then that people who complain about, this sounds a little harsh, but academic staff who are unhappy in their jobs often get tagged as misfits. And you have to work very hard to sort of dig yourself out of that hole. Perhaps more realistically, I really do not believe I was cut out to be an administrator of a larger unit than the one I administered. And when I went into the unit, it suffered from qualities which I actually cherish, meaning that we were very idiosyncratic. No, I'm not in favor of drinking too much at a campus party, but it happens from time to time. I don't think it's an enormous sin, but, you know, to each his her own. And I thought maybe I learned later that the Office of Human Resources Development knit every lunch hour, and that Jane Diamond, a great friend of mine, was known as the knitting guru of Bascom, which is by way of saying there are different cultures all over the campus. The School of Ed suited me enormously, not necessarily as an administrator. So it was difficult to make the transition, and in retrospect, I'm very proud of having done it with as much grace as I could muster when I had my feelings hurt, which I did, which is a very, very different way to describe it from saying that they'd actually made a poor administrative decision. I will go on to say, however, that both Dean Chueba and Assistant Dean Comstock left to the general joy of those who were left behind. So not that I was reinstated, that was the job that Jeff Hamm took and still does with tremendous skill and grace. So academic staff governance, I loved being part of that. I am a very, very, very strong believer in the value of talking to one another. And in the context of MASA and ASIC, I came to be passionately opposed to the kind of thing that had happened to me. But the remedy would have been conversations and ways of talking from leadership with power to the people whose situation was going to change. The whole time I was in governance, one of our ferocious wishes, and it remained the case when I went on to become an ombuds, which was very congruent with my work in academic staff governance, when leaders know things are going to change, it is absolutely their responsibility to share that information in as neutral a way as they can until they actually know who may or may not be laid off. And it's my firm conviction that any person can manage change with dignity if he or she isn't blindsided. And I remember the associate dean who got to tell me that I wasn't going to be assistant dean anymore, and she said, well, we had to make a choice and we didn't choose you. I thought, well, that in your place, lady, I would have done that a little differently, but let me just gather my tattered dignity and leave your office. Again, not to say the decision was wrong. I think right up to today, the campus is not careful to, on the one hand, integrate new staff into the glories of the university and the complexity of the university. But then at that point, when a staff person, academic staff, classified staff, or faculty takes on management of even one other person, that there's training, and training that you cannot get by reading a whole bunch of stuff on a computer and checking off that you've read it. Because at least thus far, management means managing people. And I, in my time as an ombuds, I had an argument at an ASEC meeting with a man when I said that it isn't effective to manage people who aren't in the same building. And he wondered what in the world I was talking about. Why in the world couldn't you manage effectively from another building? Well, he obviously was managing from another building. And I think it's impressive, very impressive, looking at what was accomplished, having started, not myself, but academic staff, starting with the Madison Academic Staff Association, to have created the Academic Staff Assembly, which in terms of shared governance is understood to have an equal role with faculty in the Faculty Senate and the students through Associated Students of Madison, and some of these terms may be out of date. And we are looking right now at language about changing tenure that was unthinkable during the time that academic staff and faculty and administration and students were working out and getting state legislation to support academic staff governance. So I think the campus is very healthy in those regards, independent of the budget crunch. And in my role on governance in ASEC and as chair of ASEC, I was in the statewide meetings that happened at the top of Van Hise, when my counterparts from all over the state would come. And one of my friends now is effectively chair of the appeals committee, the academic staff appeals committee, and she reports that some of the attorneys for the university speak to how much more effectively academic staff at the UW campus manage and implement and do governance than at any of the other institutions around the state, which speaks to how effectively we have been supported by central administration and by school and college administration. And when I was working in governance is when we adopted the committees on academic staff issues within schools and colleges and administrative units. And we were never 100% effective, meaning we didn't get them implemented in every school and college. But again, the deans or the dean's representative would meet on a monthly basis with academic staff leaders to talk about current issues in that school, college, or administrative unit. And that kept the information fresh and going back and forth.
Where'd it go? So maybe I'll ask it this way. So we've segued into from School of Ed to academic staff, although it's tied together because you were academic staff while you were working there. When you were in governance, who were some of the folks that were working with you?
When I went into, Shar Tortorici called me, or either she or, I'm not going to remember his name. Oh, yeah, Rick Deluge. Either Shar or Rick called to say, you need to be president of MASA. And we knew each other, Shar and I knew each other very well, from SOAR because of the testing, and also from my then being in the School of Ed. And I said, sure, I'll be president of MASA, no problem. And when I joined ASEC, pretty sure Barry Robinson, who passed, which was a great loss, but I'm pretty sure Barry Robinson was chair of ASEC. He certainly was while I was chair of ASEC, and Colleen McCabe was secretary of the academic staff. And Barry Robinson was academic staff in the theater department and ambitious to be at a higher level within academic staff roles, but that didn't happen. And I think I succeeded him as chair of ASEC. Let's see. Gail Snowden was on ASEC for a time. there's a dean from the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences who was on for a time. Ann Wallace came to the meetings but never ran for ASEC. Let's see. Belinda Velasquez was on ASEC. I said Wilt Sanders. Bill Steffenhagen was on ASEC. The woman from the synchrotron radiation laboratory was the ASPRO representative, because ASPRO's the lobbying arm, or the lobbying organization on behalf of academic staff downtown with the legislature. I can see her, I can't remember her name. And then Donna Cole came on before I left ASEC. That's as many names as I remember. And I think I've mentioned earlier that we collectively had a huge push on professorial titles for academic staff. And that seems not to have gone very far. And through that effort, we learned more about sort of differences in approaches to academic staff prestige, recognition, School of Ed, really under Palmer. But then when True Weber left and Chuck Reed came in, the School of Ed is exemplary in its support for academic staff rights. We are exemplary in the grievance, which isn't the way you start, but the recognition that there can be unhappiness with everything from how you got graded to how the School of Ed is run. And there was the equity and diversity. I lose track of which names went where. But I think it was equity and diversity committee was first in the School of Ed, and then the rules and regulations they developed were adopted at central administration. But I wasn't in that directly. I just recognized it as a sign of the respect within the School of Ed for academic staff.
So, Linda, we talked about why you retired last time, but I wonder if you could talk about your job and any changes in it as the school transitioned from, transitioned to Chuck Reed as dean.
Well, that's a good question. The under Chueva, when the two offices were put together, there was a lot of remodeling, and all of this happened before the building was remodeled. So the two floors became one office. And I don't know, I guess the way I would describe Reed in my own encounters with him that is that he's really a statesman. I mean, I think that would be the way I would describe him. So that he always represented the interests of the School of Ed in all its disparate parts as a significant part of the university as a whole, which was completely missing with Chueva. He never did. This is a complicated place, and he wasn't a student of that complexity. And one of the characteristics of Chuck Reed is that he knew everybody's name, everybody. So when he walked through the halls, he greeted everybody. And you had a very strong sense that you were welcome to stop in, but also that he was in no way, shape, or form a schmoozer, that he was very busy himself. And I got him to come talk to students about the research he had done when he was working in prisons as part of his study of the English language and literacy, and discovered that when you designed exercises for people who were incarcerated, to the extent that you controlled how much that exercise matched their experiences in school, they were less interested. And the more you could create it so that it did not match anything they'd experienced in school, they were able to perform successfully with it, which I thought was fascinating. I think Reed also brought in very, very good associate deans. I think under Palmer, the associate deans were not as, were not necessarily strong scholars, and that's very much my bias. So my memory is that Jack Keane became Dean of Teacher Certification, Associate Dean, under Reed, I think that's right, and Mariamne Whatley was the Associate Dean for issues of equity and diversity. And people, she would see anybody who was distressed by a sense that they hadn't been treated fairly. And as I said, we were a model from which the university worked. So I would say the difference for me personally was that I just felt better. And he got Emily Comstock out of there. And completely apart from her having taken a position that might have been mine, she was a dreadful, really dreadful administrator. And I know of no other situation where a bad administrator was just let go. And she went back and had a career in the schools because she was licensed and all that. So it wasn't personal. But she was just gratuitously unkind to staff. No doubt out of some personal unhappiness, but.
So there's probably more I could ask about both of that, both of those things, but I'm going to completely switch gears.
Okay.
And go to our sort of our third major topic.
Right.
Which was, last time we talked about, finding out in the 70s that your husband came out to you as gay, and you talked about, you didn't know you were a lesbian at the time, but you are, and so I wonder if we, as much as you can or want to talk about it, your journey to identifying as a lesbian.
Sure. And I have been thinking about this one, because it's not something that I think about very much. I think graduating from college as I did in 1962, and being profoundly naive, my statement, but other people have said the same, that ranges of sexuality were just something I knew nothing about. And I was quite, from a feminist perspective, wholly and entirely persuaded by heterosexuality, unnamed. And I don't know if last time I quoted the joy I experience still when I remember somewhere on State Street a graffiti or a poster that said, "And when did you figure out you were heterosexual?" So that kind of, well, of course, is anybody anything else? I mean, I wouldn't even have known to form the question. And feminism, because I was, just as soon as I began to read, and I bumped into the name Shulamith Firestone the other day, who was a wonderful feminist writer. I just hadn't thought of the name, Germaine Greer. I mean, lots and lots of women I read. And hitchhiked to California and came back. And some of this is not at all chronological, but was encountering questions on the one hand about patriarchy, which became almost overwhelming, precisely because I hadn't thought about it. And the exclusion, I mean, you look at Supreme Court justices, you look at photographs, you look at the walls anywhere on the campus when all the portraits were still up, moving into the new chair's office in the history department, and it would have been the chairman's office, and all the past chairmen that covered it. That's who they were. So that I was drawn to lots and lots of activities that were women-centered. Women only never resonated for me at all. And again, it's hard to know where my understanding came in, but patriarchy, like slavery, but you can push this way too hard, is damaging to the masters and the slaves, is damaging to men and women. Differentially, I would have to say, with some fervor. So the friendship out of which a partnership has emerged and is the partnership I'm still in, was ongoing as the most important relationship in my life, but started during my second marriage. And that marriage came apart, again, without reference to an identity question, but I can remember I was busy reading Evelyn Beck's anthology, Nice Jewish Girls, about Jewish lesbians, while still unhappily married, but not seeing any cause and effect there. And I still don't, well, who knows? I mean, part of the puzzle with all of this is, who are we as human beings, and to what extent do we, would we, is there a natural state? Of course there isn't. And then how much, sort of where is the beginning point in the conversation between the self and the culture? Well, you can't pull it apart. And at this point in my life, faith is just, you know, it grew to be larger than anything, which doesn't give you any answers to culture or individual either. So my primary relationship, my committed relationship, my sexual relationship is with one woman. And I identify as a lesbian. My partner is a lifelong lesbian and not particularly what would I want to say? She's not a public person. So we don't make a lot of noise about it. And she's personally horrified that any two people get up in front of other people and get married. So I tease her. I just asked if she wanted to go to Ireland and get married. No! Just checking. So our social life is, both of us are very involved in nonprofit activities, very different ones. So a tremendous amount of our social life has to do with dogs on the one hand, and people incarcerated on the other hand, depending on which nonprofit you're looking at. And then lots of our close friends are lesbian couples. Lots of them are very much into being lesbian parents. We're not so excited about that. I'm a parent. My partner's not particularly excited about my kids and grandkids, and that's fine with me. So I've done a fair amount of reading in feminist theory, not so much lesbian theory specifically. As I said earlier, I don't hold with separation of the genders. I'm very much a believer that the variation within a gender is as great as between. And of course now, you know, you think you've learned, this isn't actually true, but I've learned about the value of women, and I've learned to question patriarchy, and I've identified as a lesbian, and now there's transgender. And one of the people I have worked with writes about people, and I've heard about people who don't want to be assigned to either gender. And I utterly believe the validity of what they're saying. And it's to go all the way back to, we learn from one another by listening to one another, the damage done by imposition, external imposition of standards is horrendous when it's done with force. So racism, sexism. But if it were possible, and it's always possible in an argument or, you know, a conversation, to say, okay, if you lift off the oppressive piece, it remains complicated because we are so social. And we are so socially and culturally situated that it's a struggle for the variance to emerge. And people with great courage do emerge, and the sort of practical pieces of the transgender part of it, I guess, I don't know. When I was working this as an ombud, one of our visitors was somebody who really needed the campus to create more single-person locked bathrooms, which makes sense. And so the person working with that visitor could help to create a kind of survey, and I remember when there were going to be women faculty and there was going to need to be more bathrooms, or the history professor, woman history professor, who said, you know, all the tenure decisions get made in the men's room. I mean, none of it is trivial. And the extent of social management growing out of values that haven't been examined is enormous, which is a long way from being a lesbian, I know, or can be. And it's not, how do I want to say? I'm also very private. So it's not necessarily something I talk about easily, partly because my partner doesn't. And I'd say the longest standing puzzle, as we've been together almost 22 years, is her mom. and neither she nor her mother says anything. So her mother and I are very fond of each other. And, I mean, it's not exactly light, but my mom utterly adored and was adored by my partner. And when it was time for her memorial service, my first ex-husband, who's a very, very dear friend, was going to come and eulogize my mother and talk a fair amount about my mother's openness to gayness. And I had to stop him and say, "Honey, you can't talk about us." My partner's mom was there. Okay. And just at that point, there had been some issue with Green Bay Packer, where people had been very supportive of the gay side of things. So Ken, and that was Ken Bowling, who was in the history department here, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, he whipped through his talk, but there were some of Barbara's and my friends sitting there. God forbid anybody should say anything in front of her mother, but nobody did. And I think that's how people make their lives. I mean, I don't necessarily think in-laws on both sides, you know, sons-in-law and mothers-in-law of each other, necessarily share everything. And I have gay friends who won't go to bar mitzvahs and won't go to straight weddings because they're so angry. Well, I'm not angry. And where do you put the blame? I think if you're wise, you don't blame anybody, which is not intended for, I'm a great believer in consequences. But, and the personal is political. I mean, I read books that's, you know, were about the personal is political. Well, yes, that's quite obvious. But I don't think it gets us anywhere.
So maybe one more thing about that, and that's, this is me not trying to put words in your mouth, but it's going to sound like it. So it sounds like to me what you're saying is that if any activism, because part of this project we talk about, you know, being active in the community.
Right.
Like any activism you may have or had was more as being a feminist than being a lesbian.
Yes. I would say that that's, my activism was very much feminist. The other piece of it was that I was very involved with gay men and with gay men's activism before I came out to myself. So, did I talk to you about the picnic poster?
Yeah.
And that was when all my friends, almost, were gay men. And that's, of course, an exaggeration. But I have always been drawn to gay men, married one, unbeknownst to me. And occasionally when I get a crush on someone, I'll go home and my partner will say, "Well, you know, he's probably gay." Yeah, probably is. But yes, I was and remain a feminist. And race. I mean, if I were to say where my activism is now, it's through church, a white church with a black pastor, and spending time on a regular basis in a black church. It's about the unbelievably racial disparities, the ways in which Dane County has managed not to provide equal education to black kids.
Thank you for all that.
Oh, you're welcome.
Something that was not on here, but since this might be our last session, you've referred to it a couple of times. I knew about this, and I keep forgetting to ask you about this, and this is your role as an ombudsman. So I wonder if you could start by how that all started.
Sure, sure. Let's see. When I retired from the university, I went to Edgewood to study religion. And the chronology is not altogether clear. I wanted to minister with a lowercase m, and I got involved with Madison Area Road Ministry, which really supported that and still does call. And I got the ombuds office on the campus, and this is changing, but at that point were four retired, it's one FTE, four occupants, each a quarter time for the whole campus except medicine and pharmacy. And those four people could be retired academic staff, faculty, or classified staff. And the process by which the job search goes on is that you look at the list of retirees, because once I was an ombuds, I was doing this, and then you send out the ad. The terms were generally 3 years. I served for four. So I got the ad, and I remember sitting in my dining room thinking, I could do this. And I think, not irrelevant, two of the standing ombuds at that point, sitting, I guess we'd say, were Richard Ralston, retired faculty, and Kay Simmons, retired academic staff, both of whom were the kind of really close friends you make on campus, but the friendship doesn't particularly extend into your personal life. So I applied, and I think it was the best slash easiest letter of application I ever wrote, because the job so exactly fit me. And by the time I retired, and I probably have said this already, what I came to understand was I was put on this earth to listen. And that the alchemy of listening is beyond magic. And that 99% of the people walking around on campus need to sit down very, very quietly and talk about what's troubling them right now with someone who will just listen. So that's what I said in the letter. And I got the job. Now, I mentioned Rich and Kay because I suspect, and it's just what it is, that they might have been favorable to me, but that was based on knowing each other, so it's not the end of the world. Anyway, I took the job. And Kay rotated off. So I started working with Pat Willeet, retired faculty from counseling psych in the School of Ed, and she and I knew each other from working in the School of Ed and in governance. And Richard Ralston, a person I truly love, and did while I was in the history department. He did African history. And he was in Bascom in administration, perhaps working for Shane, I'm not sure. And I trust that the archives have interviewed him. Fascinating person. So he and I and Pat Willeet and then John Mather from the College of Agriculture, and who, as I get to walk up here from parking, I get to look at the Allen Centennial Gardens, and John Mather was central in making that happen. And what we did was, every month one of us took each week, and we staffed the phone, which was remote. In other words, we didn't sit in our office with the phone, but we checked the phone every 24 hours or even more frequently. And then sometimes the person wanted Pat Willeet, and then I'd pass it along. Or if they designated nobody, everybody that I heard from that week was mine. And we talked on the phone, we went and visited. It was entirely confidential, entirely independent, entirely informal. And there's always a fourth one, I don't remember. But what that meant is we reported to nobody. And that is in law all over the country, because we were less formally trained than a professional ombuds, but we practice by the same rules. And there is a central U.S., mid-U.S. summer conference that does training every summer. On the first day and the second day, the ombuds all talk ombuds to each other. And so we all went to it for years and years. It was in DeKalb, Illinois. It's back there this summer, but that's just because it's rotating. So we hosted that here a couple years before. I was an ombud from 10 to 14. And part of the length of tenure had to do with the brief and unremarkable career of Damon Williams. So Damon Williams came in as ombuds, got started here under Peter Speer when he was provost, because when he was dean of the college, I think, at University of Colorado Boulder, he was very, very impressed with ombuds. So he brought it here. And then the physicist who started ethnic studies, a woman, took, and she was, I think, vice provost for maybe faculty and staff. She took the ombuds into her, under her line. But then when Williams came on and was chief diversity officer, it got moved over there, which made no sense. And one of the things that we realized going to the trainings is that ombuds are effective, maximally effective, if they answer only to the chief academic officer, because the aggregate data we provide, first of all, Damon Williams, I mean, you should excuse me, but I got to know him fairly well. He didn't know anything about this campus and never learned anything about this campus. So if we would have gone to say to him, we're really, really troubled by the Weissman Center. Hmm? Weissman Center? Or staff at the Weissman Center. So we worked with Eden Inouye-Rani, who's a person who makes this whole campus possible on a daily basis. And then she worked very closely with DeLuca, and he said, this makes no sense, and took us back, so that we now report to the provost. So that would be Sarah Mengelsdorf. And we worked very closely during my tenure with the appeals committee to educate academic staff as fully as we could to what constitutes a viable appeal, because there's lots and lots and lots of unhappiness in work situations and a sense of unjust things happening. But the standards by which a case is adjudicated are very clear and very specific, and we're trying to prevent, we collectively in academic staff, prevent people from wasting time. And people get themselves into a situation, and these are generalizations, of course, either where they really know, underline, that their supervisor needs their help in elucidating to the supervisor how to do that job. And when that's unappreciated, they get upset. Or their coworkers are annoying, and I'm getting now more into what comes to the ombuds. But even more so when they're thinking about appealing, that the university itself will be deeply distressed that they're unhappy in their job. And we have to say to them, the university is indifferent. The university has rules and regulations that apply to faculty, that apply to academic staff, that apply to classified staff. And generally speaking, we all hope those rules and regulations are followed. And when they're not, there is a general sense that there needs to be a corrective. But nobody except perhaps the ombuds who's listening, and we're supposed to be neutral, that was the other one. We will give you all kinds of sympathy, but we will also try to disabuse you of the notion that the university is going to be wringing its hands over your situation. You're hired to do the job. The first wisdom that comes out of having been an ombuds is read your job description. And nobody is asking you to do anything different. And if the job description changes, it is your responsibility to see to it that the written one reflects what it is your supervisor expects you to do. And we are simultaneously, which I also alluded to, passionately in favor of supervisor training, and we don't believe there's any on this campus that's effective, even remotely. And any time, I mean, certainly for academic staff, you ought to have a performance review. Well, swell. And many times somebody comes to the ombuds and has never had a performance review, or almost worse, starts to get them at the point at which the supervisor has decided to get rid of them. So ombuds, the piece that I haven't quite said is that friendships form there, and this has been tested, I mean, you know me well enough to know now probably, that I have been testifying to it like crazy from practically my second day on the job, but even the most reserved of the foursomes that I worked with, because they changed over time, herself acknowledged. It's a transformative experience because of the level of collaboration and the level of commitment which emerges as you work, because we are relatively protected from the ways in which the university isn't careful. And that's what we learned about. And now there is, I'm very pleased to say, one of the four ombuds is Dale Burke, who's a retired classified staff. So there's one classified staff, one faculty, and two academic staff at this point. And one of those academic staff, to make it really personal, and the one who is the most miraculous of a friend, is Sandy Guthrie. And she just decided to extend her stay, which is fabulous, because her combination of expertise and no-nonsense is just absolutely invaluable. She does more good for everybody she talks to just in knowing what the regulations are, knowing what the facts are, and pointing them in that direction. Because a lot of people don't explore what their benefits are and how they may or may not use them depending on what they decide to do about their jobs. So.
Linda, I always try to leave you with the last word. This might be our final session, so I want to make sure that you have space here to say anything you feel you need to say before we close.
No, I think the only thing I would say is I think it's an extremely good thing that you're doing the work that you're doing, and I think you do it amazingly well. I so treasure who and what this place is, and it's really, really good that individual stories are being collected. There's no other way to get at, I mean, Donna Shalala was very good at talking about having been astounded every day she was here by how much this institution is loved. And I believe her. Maybe they love Michigan too. It could be. Seems unlikely to me. But it's the stories. So thank you.
Well,
thank you, Linda. So this concludes the fourth oral history session with Linda Newman.